James Petras is a Bartle Professor Emeritus at Binghamton University, New York, author of 62 books published in 29 languages, over 500 articles in professional journals, and over 2,000 articles in such publications as the New York Times, The Nation, The Guardian, Christian Science Monitor, and Le Monde Diplomatique. He has been one of the few courageous individuals in or outside of academia to take a critical view of the pro-Israel lobby and its influence on U.S. Middle East policy, and his new book, The Power of Israel in the United States, just published by Clarity Press, is not only timely, it's the most hard-hitting exposure of this unholy relationship that I've ever read. I want to welcome James Petras to Takes on the World. Hello, James.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for the introduction, but I have to tip my hat to you because that's reading your newsletter that you send out over the internet, that's been an enormous help to my work. So I need to say that because it's very much evident in my book. Just going over all the sources that you survey every day, it's amazing kind of groundwork that you lay out for any serious analysis of the role of the Jewish lobby in the United States.
Well, thank you. So we are mutual admiration, so I appreciate your appreciation. I appreciate what you've done with it. Next week, we're going to have another midterm election, and most of those opposed to the ongoing war in Iraq are hoping for the Democrats to recapture the House and possibly the Senate from the Republicans. Given what you have written and what you and I both know about the origins of that war, will a Democratic victory at the polls bring us a marked change of policy in Iraq, or in the confrontation with Iran, or in towards anything resembling a just resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which is tied to both of those issues?
Well, any serious analysis of the Democrats, the Democratic Party, the leading lights, the main funding organization selected funding for the Democratic election, the election of Democrats, is run by a former Israeli, Israeli-American, if you will, and looking over the list of candidates that he's been funding, it looks like more war and less overtures to the Palestinians. I think we cannot expect people like Charles Schumer and Hillary Clinton, who've declared publicly and openly that the interests of Israel are the interests of the United States, we cannot expect any initiatives on Palestine. And the same goes for Iraq. If one reads closely, it's Schumer and Hillary Clinton who are calling for more troops and who are talking that Bush failed in the quest for victory. There's no indication at all that at least the leading lights and the leading presidential candidates, the leading party officials, are anything but supportive of an escalation of the war. So I don't think from that vantage point that we can expect any changes. However, saying that, we also should recognize that many of the Democratic voters, I would say the latest polls that I've read, up to 60% are for a de-escalation, a withdrawal of U.S. troops. So you have here a conflict between the Democratic voters and the people they're voting for, a disjuncture between the party and the voters. And that's one indication. The same goes with American Jews. You find a majority of American Jews are opposed to the war and calling for withdrawal, and a majority are looking toward Israeli-Palestinian negotiations toward a settlement, which goes contrary to AIPAC and the noisy organizations that are called the Israeli lobby. So there's quite a disjuncture between rank-and-file American voters, whether they're Jews or non-Jews, on the questions of the day.
Of course, the difference is the Congress people listen to those who donate the big bucks and are able to intimidate them both before and after Election Day.
Well, part of it is intimidation, Jeff, in the sense that they depend on, and this is well known, over 50% of the funding of the Democratic Party comes from wealthy pro-Israel Zionists. And most of those people, at least up to now, have been fanatically, unconditionally pro-Israel and followed the lead of AIPAC. And this is a big problem that the U.S. politicians, both for ideological, financial, and for reasons of pressure, are taking a direction which is going to destroy the fabric of American social and political life.
Well, what's left of it.
Yeah. Well, we still have Jeff Blankford's program and some noises coming out of Pacifica, which are anti-war. But certainly the legislative framework with the Patriot Act and the latest legislation coming from the Bush administration certainly is shredding the Constitution and what's remaining of our Bill of Rights.
Well, of course, one of the things the lobby pushed for the war in Iraq, and is the only sector in society, American society, that is pushing for war in Iran. And it's interesting that a number of the Democrats who now oppose the war voted for what was called the Iran Freedom Act and are pushing for a U.S. confrontation with Iran, which would seem insane.
Yes, and I think here is a important point that when you get a single-issue organization like the Jewish lobby or what is called the pro-Israel lobby, bullet voting on the war in Iran and mobilizing all the grassroots resources, and I'm not just talking about AIPAC, I'm talking about the presence of the major Jewish organizations, the local federations, their whole network, grassroots network, which involves a couple hundred thousand people, and they are able to make a huge dent on U.S. foreign policy, in particular, pushing for these war maneuvers off the coast of Iran, and in general, casting U.S. policy in a very confrontational way with Iran, and through the U.S., its influence in the Security Council, rounding up the Europeans to back the same policy. So there's a kind of chain reaction here that starts at the grassroots, works through the regional and national organizations, affects the U.S. Congress and the U.S. executive, which in turn influences in the international arena. And this is an extraordinarily dangerous policy because it will set off a conflagration in the Middle East. And it goes against the interests of big oil. The military is certainly not happy with getting dragged into another war when it can't handle the current wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and will certainly become the fall guy when this house of cards collapses. So we have the Zioncrans and the civilian militarists, people like Rumsfeld and Cheney, up against a very powerful set of interests who haven't really organized themselves in an effective political way yet.
Well, actually, your reference to big oil, given, in part one of your book entitled Zionist Power in America, you begin chapter one with the question, who fabricated the Iraqi war threat? I take it wasn't big oil, as all the anti-war protest banners declared.
Yes. None of them, by the way, have done any interviewing, research on documents, public statements by any and all of the oil companies, and I have. And in the run-up, the five-year run-up to the Iraq invasion, I can't find a single organized effort by the oil companies to push for war to grab the Iraqi oil. As a matter of fact, all the big oil companies were fairly satisfied with the relative peaceful environment. They were very busy signing oil contracts with the Arab and Muslim countries. Some of them were double dealing under the table with the oil for food, Iraqi oil exchange. They certainly were dealing directly or indirectly with Iran. So this is all a red herring that Noam Chomsky and others, Michael Clare, cooked up to and attributed it in a very simplistic way. Oil, somehow big oil will benefit from the invasion, and that they sponsored the war. Well, they haven't benefited. It's jeopardized their interests in the Middle East. There's no evidence that they're actively involved in lobbying, pressuring, organizing in favor of the war. And so they ignore the enormous efforts by people like Wolfowitz and Douglas Feith, fanatical Zionists, long-time connections with Israel. In fact, one of them lost his security clearance for handing over documents to Israel. They overlook Elliot Abrams, the National Security Council. They overlook Frum, who wrote the Axis of Evil speech for Bush. They overlook Richard Perle. They overlook Crystal. They overlook Cohen. They overlook every ideologue who is pushing for war in Washington in order to suck out of their thumb this whole idea of big oil. And it's a travesty of any kind of serious research that people like Chomsky have continued to ignore the facts. The majorities in Congress that rolled out in favor of the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. I just think that it's a case of tribal loyalties when it comes down to it. Chomsky will invent an oil pressure when he knows, or should know through any observations, that it was the Israeli lobby which was deeply involved, deeply present in the Pentagon and other government agencies in fabricating the evidence, in designing the war, in promoting the war, and in executing the war.
No, it's interesting you mentioned Chomsky, of course, who is kind of the authority, reigning authority on Israel being the cop on the beat, the U.S. client state in the Middle East, and yet in his in a number of books he's written, his references, the last reference he has is over 40 years old, and the references don't stand up. I actually remember a mutual friend of Chomsky's, myself, the late Israel Shahak, Professor Israel Shahak, who was a Holocaust survivor from Poland, and was the person responsible, according to Chomsky, getting Chomsky even to speak publicly about this issue, wrote to me in 1991 that no doubt his friend Chomsky helps the Zionists by taking this position. And it's unfortunate that people, when you bring this up about the lobby, they start quoting Chomsky as if they have imbibed him as the oracle on this subject. You also get into that another recent fast becoming icon of the anti-war movement, Seymour Hersh, and his articles in The New Yorker, which are read as gospel by people in the movement. You have some really telling criticism of Seymour Hersh's articles exposing the U.S. role in Iraq and Iran.
Yes, I read through very carefully Seymour's articles, and it's very strange because the main villains in the piece are essentially Rumsfeld and Cambone, a third-level functionary in the Pentagon. But he leaves out very conspicuously Wolfowitz and Douglas Feith. He leaves out Elliot Abrams. He leaves out Frum, who were, Wolfowitz designed the war, Feith set up the special committee with his buddy Chomsky, another Zionist, that cooked up and channeled the falsified information into the White House. He leaves out Irving Libby, so-called Scooter Libby, who was in the vice president's office, another fanatical Zionist protege of Wolfowitz, and he presents us with a Zion-less portrait of the making of the Iraq War. And then subsequently, what he's mad about is not that the war is being carried out, that these villains are involved in massacres, but that they're prejudicing the assassination, the special teams that are operating, kidnapping, and murdering suspects all over the world. Hirsch looks at those people as somehow very positive operators, and that the mushheads in the Pentagon, namely the non-Zionists, are making it difficult for them to carry on their extraterritorial felonies. So he's not anywhere near a progressive, though. When he gets on the lecture circuit, he touches the right buttons. He doesn't bring out the special forces that are clandestine operations, which he writes so favorably about in his New Yorker articles.
Well, you actually...
By the way, he also, right after 9/11, he came out in favor of torture on public radio, something which a lot of people forget.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of that until I read it in your book. We're speaking with James Petras, author of a new book called The Power of Israel in the United States, and I'll tell you how to get that at the end of the program. You had alluded to this earlier, but one of the eternal problems that I find within the left and its spokespersons is that they see the ruling class, the American ruling class, as monolithic and single-minded, which makes them unable and perhaps even unwilling to see the divisions that are readily visible, such as that between the neocons or the Zionicons and their frontmen Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld. And the old-line establishment that opposed the war from the beginning, represented by Bush Sr., James Baker, and key figures in the intelligence establishment. And you show how these are being played out in the investigations of key AIPAC higher-ups, and more recently the link between AIPAC and Democratic Congresswoman Jane Harman, who has her eyes on the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, should the Democrats win. And in your book, you describe how this conflict is playing out and the resentments in Washington against the Israelization of U.S. policy, and you bring in the affair of Libby, but you also go into other details.
Yes, and I think the setting up of the Baker, the Iraq Study Committee, is a crystallization of these anti-Zionist empire builders. Let's be straight. The fight is over how to manage and how to consolidate the U.S. empire. Neither side is in any way anti-imperialist. But one side is more market-oriented, that is, that sees building the empire in large part through the expansion and operations of multinational corporations, and see the military as more or less a selective instrument in the operations of empire building. They are very angry with the takeover, the Zionist takeover of foreign policy and the use of the U.S. military to carry out Israel's foreign policy, particularly in the Middle East, and secondly, of subordinating business interests to military adventures. And I think these are two fundamental differences that divide these two groups. And I think Baker has put together a very interesting panel of 10, none of which are connected in any way to the ZionCon establishment. But working groups, which include here and there a ZionCon among the 40 active researchers, and I think certainly Baker will not directly attack the ZionCons and the Rumsfelds, but he will put forth a position which is incompatible with their militarist Zionist priorities, and which I think will be a pressure point, at least within the leading circles of the U.S. government, for a change. And I think he will look toward co-opting some sectors of the Democratic Party in order for them to be able to work with him. The problem is, among the leadership of the Democratic Party, he's going to have to deal with the professional pro-Israelites, and this is not exactly a working group for Baker. So he'll have to look toward pressuring the Democrats to come across as an independent political vehicle on this, and I think he's going to have great difficulty because he's more likely to get what from the grassroots politicians in the Republican Party than he will from getting support from the Democrats. So I think Baker has power. So I think the question is, where can Baker build a base? He has support in the elite. He has support in public opinion. But where does he get the congressional leverage? Where does he get leverage within the executive branch? This is not clear to me.
It's interesting that the strongest statements about questioning the war are, other than from the fringe of the Democratic Party, are coming from Republican senators.
Yes, and also from conservatives.
Yes.
If you read Raimundo and others, I think you'll see that it's the conservatives, the nationalists, who are very upset by the fact that Israel is not is dominating U.S. policy, and they don't like that. If you will, it's nationalism, chauvinism, or whatever, but the fact of the matter is that they are very angry that U.S. policy is being made in the interests of the Israeli state rather than for U.S. Policy in the elite.
One of the things that in where the senior Bush and Baker disagree with the present administration is who the administration can talk. Now, we were all back during the Carter administration, thanks to the energies of Bobby and Henry Kissinger, to talk to the PLO, and when Andrew the position, I think a UN delegate under Carter's, a UN representative under Carter, was found to have spoken with the PLO and was to resign. You have a situation where even though Baker has said publicly, and Breiner did talk to discuss the decision not to speak, recognize leaders of Hamas, or speak of Hamas, speak to Bashar al-Assad in Damascus, is apparently the pressure of the Israel lobby, in which any American politician would do so, would pay the price. So even in a disputed election victory, it's up to lobbying who the President of the United States representatives can do. And this is something, obviously, that he has actually said publicly. You talk to your enemy.
Yes, this is part of the taboo that I imposed by the laws of mass democracy. And I think this is really something that has really bothered me, is that we can criticize Bush, but we can't criticize Sharon or Olmert. We can criticize the gun lobby, but we can't criticize the Jewish lobby. And I think that these two are really destroying American democracy, not just at the national level. Here in Binghamton, this godforsaken town of 50,000 people, if you criticize the lobby in the local paper, you get the tooth squad, the local doctors and dentists that come down and visit you at your office and demand to know why you're playing into the anti-Semitic, neo-fascist, neo-Nazi conspiracy. So it's really having a terrible effect. There was a columnist here, a leading columnist with Gannett, that 20 years ago or 25 years ago wrote a column on the Israeli invasion, Sabra Shatila, and compared it to Kristallnacht. And the local notables visited the editors and tried to get them fired, and the poor fellow has never written another single article criticizing Israel, let alone the lobby. So This kind of political thuggery operates not only at the national level dealing with Congress, but in devastating civil society here and democratic criticism and involvement at the very local level.
Well, Mendocino is not occupied territory, but when I was in San Francisco back about 20 years ago, I used to get progressive Israelis, including former military officers like General Matti Peled, on the air, on TV, on radio, interviewed by the newspapers. This is 20 years ago. Now, is it possible to get a progressive Israeli critic of Israel interviewed or on the mainstream radio in San Francisco? And one Professor Ilan Pape was met with a Chronicle reporter through the actions of a mutual friend, and the reporter told Pape right away, Matthew Stannard of the Chronicle, I'm not going to write a story about you. So the lobby leans very heavily on in local areas. This is what gives us its strength. If it was only AIPAC alone, AIPAC wouldn't have the strength, but it's the grassroots activists for Israel that keep people from speaking out. It's, if you want to be a politician in this country, it's jeopardizing your career to criticize Israel.
That is true. On the other hand, I think we have to realize that there is a growing number of Americans that either through the alternative media, the internet, who are very critical and are pointing the finger at the role of the lobby. The survey recently by Zogby points out that in the age group between 18 and 31, the percentage of people who think the lobby played a role in shaping U.S. war policy to Iraq, that grew 51%, if we can go by the reliability of the Zogby survey. There are a majority of young people think that the Israel factor was an essential factor in determining us going to war. And I think in general, I've gotten quite a bit of email. I've looked at surveys, and the Congress does not reflect American public opinion on the role of the lobby in putting us into this situation in the Middle East.
Nor does the anti-war movement, because, for example, in San Francisco, where you have Nancy Pelosi, one of the most powerful Democrats in Congress, and Tom Lantos, who is one of the fomenters of the first Iraq war, as well as this one, and represents Israel as a diplomat in countries where they have no diplomatic recognition, which is reported in the Jerusalem Post. You never hear serious criticism of Pelosi or Lantos at anti-war rallies. This is the lobby is also not mentioned by the movement. I'm sure some of our listeners might object to use of the term Jewish lobby as opposed to Israel lobby, pro-Israel lobby, or Zionist lobby.
That's
what I was going to say.
In Israel, they don't have any compunctions. Now, I did get email from progressive Jews that said, look, I'm a Jew, and I'm opposed to the lobby. I'm opposed to Israel. You shouldn't mention that. And the point is that the lobby is made up of Jewish organizations, which doesn't mean that every Jew supports the lobby. On the contrary, if you look at the lobby and its activists, they represent less than 10% of all Jews, and probably, if you put it to a vote, their policies, particularly AIPAC, are not supported by the great majority of Jews. Nevertheless, those Jews that oppose the lobby are not organized. They don't have any influence in any way on policy. And to the degree that there is opposition, it's very diluted and compromised. And I'm talking about people like Rabbi Lerner, who are constantly berating Israel and then turning out and supporting it. So this is a kind of conflictual situation where people have to get straight that it's one thing to oppose the lobby, and it's another thing to draw a line with those people who are supporting the lobby in its policies.
Well, it's interesting, having been in Israel and spoken about this issue, the mainstream journalists, as you say, refer to the Jewish lobby, and the left does as well, because they see all of organized U.S. Jewry as being essentially functioning to support Israel, irrespective of their positions of resolving the Israeli-Palestinian problem. They all support continued aid to Israel, they support the loan guarantees to Israel, and they don't see any support, actually, of anti-Zionist Israelis who are active or try to be active inside Israel. They get no support of any substance from American Jews who may be critical of the lobby. And so in Israel, they see the image that they see and the results that they see. They don't call it pro-Israel lobby because many of them think that what the lobby does not help them at all. So it's not pro-Israel. In their sense, it's critical. They're critical of the lobby and the lobby's attempts to get more money all the time. Matter of fact, during the first effort to get 10 billion loan guarantees in 1991, a major religious Sephardic Jewish leader accused American Jews of being greedy, quote, and he used the English term greedy, because he said that there are obviously people in American cities, Chicago, Miami, Detroit, and so on, that had more need of that money than did Israel.
Well, that's true in many ways. The per capita income in Israel is about $22,000, and yet it gets more aid than all of Africa and Latin America put together, Africa minus Egypt. And I think this is really, if you think of foreign aid to aid needy countries in that way, the Israeli lobby trumps any hunger and famines in Africa and mass poverty that exists in the Caribbean and Haiti and Bolivia elsewhere. This wasn't always the way, you know. When I was growing up in the 40s and early 50s, most of the Jews were not Zionists. Many were New Deal Democrats, many were Social Democrats, many were progressives, leftists, communists. I remember growing up and working in the fish market with my father, and it was a tremendous variety of views, and the local Hadassah women sending raffle tickets had problems selling the tickets among Jews, because many of them would argue that the problems for Jews are here in the United States and not in supporting Israel. And I think this phenomena grew and took a life of its own, and eventually, I think, highlighted by the 1967 sinking of the Liberty and the subsequent 7 days war, there was really a turnaround. And I remember Mike Lerner, the rabbi, at that time being big on Soviet immigration to Israel under the banner of fighting against the repression of Jews, who happened to be the highest status group in the Soviet Union, the oppressed wealthy minority. Eventually, what that policy led to was a growth of Jewish chauvinism and tribalism, and the settlements in Palestine of these mad Russian immigrants, many of whom now form the backbone for Lieberman, the Judeo-fascist, who's now entering the government in Israel. And I think the chain of events takes us back to the 60s.
Well, I mentioned earlier in the narrative I do before I called you about Mr. Lieberman and his history, and the fact that only one person in the Israeli cabinet from Labor opposed him and resigned, and there's been not a word of criticism from any of the major American Jewish organizations about this openly racist, we have to call him a Judeo-Nazi, being a member of this cabinet. This is a man who was a beer hall bouncer from Moldova, born after the war, and he's come there, and he's become like a bully boy inside Israel. He's a deputy prime minister in charge of strategic assets. We're actually coming down to the end of the hour, Jim, and I'm really happy to have had you aboard, and I'm going to try and do this again at another time because we didn't get into a number of other aspects of this very powerful book, The Power of Israel in the United States. And it is available from Clarity Press. You can call them at 888-281-5170, or you should go. I'd like you to go to your local bookstores and ask them to get this book for you. This is, as I say, you pull no punches. And this is the issue where punches are pulled all the time. So, James Petras, again, I want to thank you for your courage and for being our guest today. And keep on keeping on, as they say.
Well, thanks a lot for having me on, Jeff.